In 1915, San Diego, California was in the midst of a deep, devastating drought. With no rain in sight and people suffering, the city desperately turned to an uncommon and highly controversial solution, Charles Mallory Hatfield, a self-professed, quote, moisture accelerator to bring rain to its parched lands. Now, Hatfield's journey to becoming a rainmaker began on his father's ranch in Bonsall, California, where he conducted his first rainmaking experiments atop a windmill tower. By 1904, he had convinced several California farmers and ranchers that he could draw moisture from the skies using a secret chemical cocktail. Hatfield's claims were bold. He didn't make it rain, he simply attracted the clouds, and the clouds did the rest. His reputation grew, and soon he was guaranteeing rainfall in exchange for hefty fees. Now, San Diego, suffering from dangerously low reservoir levels, decided to give Hatfield a chance. On December 13, 1915, Hatfield promised the city council he could fill the Marina Reservoir within a year for $10,000, payable only if he succeeded. Despite the skepticism of some council members, Hatfield began his work. He constructed a 20-foot tower near the reservoir and released his chemical mixture into the air. And the initial results were promising. A light sprinkle greeted the new year, and soon steady rain followed. Then, on January 15, 1916, the heavens opened, and it seemed like a biblical downpour. Over the next 5 days, up to 17 inches of rain fell, causing landslides and floods that devastated San Diego. The rain continued intermittently, and by the end of January, nearly 30 inches had fallen, making it the wettest period in the region's recorded history. This deluge caused significant damage, including the catastrophic failure of a reservoir dam, which resulted in over a dozen deaths. So despite the chaos, Hatfield believed he had fulfilled his end of the bargain, and he sought his $10,000 payment. However, the city, which was now inundated with lawsuits from flood victims, refused to pay, arguing that no formal contract had existed and that Hatfield couldn't prove that he caused the rain. Hatfield sued, but after 2 decades of litigation, he received zero, not a cent, from the city of San Diego. Hatfield's story is a captivating blend of ambition, science, and the timeless human desire to control nature, but it's much more than that. It's illustrative of how I think many creative pros feel. Someone hires us to solve a problem. We disappear and we blend up our own mixture of chemicals, sending the smoke skyward. And when the rain comes, our clients wonder what exactly we did. When we're doing creative work, and especially when we're leading creative work, we need to help others understand what it actually takes to do our work. We need to connect the dots for them. We need maps, and we need to find ways to help others navigate those maps to get to the treasure at the end. On today's episode, we're going to explore how to better bring clarity to our process and how to better connect the dots between ideas and actions in creative work. This is Daily Creative, a podcast for creative pros who want to be brave, focused, and brilliant every day. My name is Todd Henry. Welcome to the show.
A lot of what I teach now is that the best product doesn't always win, the best idea doesn't always win, the best person doesn't always win. And once we acknowledge that, we as creators can really take responsibility for connecting the dots from our idea or our product, our innovation, and bridge to our audiences, our customers, our coworkers about, hey, why would they care about this? Why does this matter? And I know that it's frustrating for a lot of people who do creative work that people don't understand them or don't understand their ideas, but I want people to know that it's definitely a skill that you can learn and build and practice.
That's Wes Kao, a brand strategist and co-founder of Maven, an ed tech company. I chatted with Wes a few years ago about the importance of making maps, not just following them. In our conversation, she shared her thoughts about why some creative pros struggle to get their ideas heard inside of their organizations or with their clients. And one of the biggest reasons is that they simply don't connect the dots.
There's a big difference between having an insight and having an assertion about what action should we take because of this insight. So I'll tell a quick story. Early in my career, I worked with some of the smartest people at the Gap headquarters in San Francisco. And I was super excited to be there. I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And after work, I would put together trend boards. So I would put together, you know, magazine cutouts, and I'd bring it to the senior leaders, and I'd say stuff like, legging sales have been going up a lot, and, you know, or fringe. We're seeing a lot of high-end designers using fringe. We're seeing that as a trend. Or I'd say stuff like, okay, a lot of brands are offering activewear. I would do this, and I would pat myself on the back when I pointed out these insights, and I expected everyone else to pat me on the back too. And that really was not the case. And one day, one of the senior merchants, my boss's boss, was this brilliant woman named Susie. And I went into her office, brought one of these trend boards, and she really stopped me. And she said, okay, Wes, this is great, but what is the next step? What should we do? What are you suggesting? What action should we really take? And I realized that I didn't have a good answer for that. And it was super frustrating because I thought, hey, I had done my part. I brought you these insights. I thought this is what you wanted. And, you know, these are my great ideas. But I didn't understand until years later that Susie was really trying to help me see that an insight is not the same thing as a suggestion or an assertion for taking action. And an insight really alone isn't enough. A lot of people think they have great ideas and they think they're doing what their boss has said to do by bringing up these ideas. But there's a big difference between pointing out something versus going the extra steps to say, okay, I've thought deeper about how this would work and how this would impact our business. And here are the actions that we should take. And I'm willing to go out on a limb, put myself on the line, and commit to taking responsibility for how I would bring this about into the real world. And here's a small, easy way that we can test this hypothesis. That's just so different than, you know, bringing a trend board to someone and saying, hey, fringe is really in this year.
Just having an idea is not enough. And sometimes sharing an idea too soon can be just as pointless as not sharing it at all. If you want to prove to your manager or your client that you can, quote, make it rain, you have to show them that you've thought through not only the idea itself, but how it can be implemented, the potential pitfalls, and how you would deal with setbacks, and how you might be able to test the idea to see if it would work. And that, Wes says, is the difference between a mere insight and an assertion.
And a lot of times an insight is pointing something out that you think is interesting or different or unexpected. But it doesn't really go the extra step to say, you know, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? And I actually divide this into three parts. So insights versus suggestions versus assertions. And if you think of a spectrum of how much am I personally putting myself on the line and having skin in the game with wanting to advocate for a certain path, insights would be on the far left where, hey, I'm pointing out something, for example, this coffee cup is black. Okay. It's a to-go coffee cup. That's it. It's black. Okay, cool. Now moving further right to the middle is a suggestion. So maybe it's saying, hey, there are a lot of coffee shops in the area. All the to-go cups are black. So what if we made ours yellow? Because that's really going to stand out. And there's going to be people walking around, you know, a 5-block radius who are going to associate that with our storefront and logo color, et cetera. So I suggest that we do a brighter color. And then on the far right, the very far right extreme, which is where I think more people should be and should go, is to come up with an assertion and to actually advocate for a point of view. And so that's saying, okay, of all the bright colors, I think we should do yellow because that's our logo color. And I've taken a step to look into the printing costs, and our supplier says it's actually the same cost to print yellow versus black. We can do a limited run of 500 cups, test out how it goes. And if it doesn't work, we'll go back to black. People have pretty short memories. So no one's going to say, okay, we've damaged our brand. But it's essentially going that extra step to say, you know, I thought about how this is going to work, and I'm willing to speak with conviction and advocate for a path as opposed to just suggesting. You know, suggesting is like me saying, hey, Todd, I'm putting a couple options out for you. You have to pick. And the implicit agreement or the unspoken social contract is that you, Todd, because you picked, if things go wrong, I'm not at fault. You're at fault. You're ultimately right because you picked. But when you're advocating for a point of view, you're the one that says, hey, I, Wes, am saying we should try the yellow cups. And Todd, if this doesn't work, it's on me. I'm going to fix it. And I've thought about how this would work.
Think about how much different this approach is than the one that many creative pros take. Offering up ideas, then placing the impetus for choosing on the stakeholder. It's almost as if we are washing our hands of the consequences. But, and this is a big but, if we are willing to move from the far left side of the spectrum, mere insights, to the far right of the spectrum, assertions, and to back those assertions up with our own credibility, how much more influential might we be in conversations? How much more might our leadership or clients trust us? But Wes says it's not just enough to make an assertion. That assertion has to have a spiky point of view.
A spiky point of view is something that stands out and has a real assertion behind it. So going back to what we were saying about the differences between an insight and an assertion, a spiky point of view is something that has a thesis that people can disagree with. And I think that, you know, a lot of times we want to prioritize people liking us. And so we'll kind of round out the edges of ideas that started off originally as pretty bold, spiky ideas. And then gradually we make them smaller and smoother and rounder. And there's not that edge anymore. There's not that sharpness that could end up upsetting some people, or people could disagree, or it could be controversial. So a spiky point of view is really something where you say, hey, I believe really strongly in this. And someone could push back and say, Wes, I think that's baloney, and I absolutely think the opposite, and here's why. But it ends up really creating opportunities for conversations to happen and for people to have something to go off of. It kind of goes back again to the insights and assertions, because when you just point something out, you know, the sky is blue, okay. No one, there's nothing really to talk about there. But if you assert something and you give it your own unique take and your opinion and your spin on it, there's something that people can work with, whether it's I agree or I disagree, but it moves the conversation forward as opposed to just standing still.
Wes Kao is the co-founder of Maven. You can find Wes's writings and other work at weskao.com. That's weskao.com. And you can hear my full, very insightful interview with Wes at the Daily Creative app at dailycreative.app. Hi, everyone. This is Todd Henry. My new book, The Brave Habit, is available now wherever books are sold, in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. I think it's my favorite book I've ever written, and a lot of people are telling me it's their favorite book as well. I think you're going to like it. So check it out wherever books are sold or at thebravehabit.com. Now, on with the show. So in my third book, Louder Than Words, I shared the story of a musical artist who got his big break. And I often love to tell this story when I go out and I give speeches. It's one of my favorite ways to end a talk. So July of 1967, a young musician was given the opportunity of a lifetime. It was the chance to tour as the opening act for one of the most popular bands of the day. And this band wasn't just popular. I mean, they were drawing people to arenas all over the country. So for a young, relatively unknown musician, this was a huge opportunity. So of course they said yes. The night came for the first performance, and as they introduced this new artist, this opening act, the crowd went silent, and he walked out on the stage, and he picked up his guitar, and he began to play. But after a couple of songs, the crowd livened up. Unfortunately, it wasn't quite the response he was hoping for. Instead of cheers, it was boos. Boos as in booing, not as in the other kind of boos. But like a pro, he finished the set, put his guitar down and walked off stage to the boos of thousands of people. Could you imagine how that would feel in that moment? You just got your opportunity to play in front of thousands of people in a giant arena, and you got booed off stage. You would have to feel like a failure in that moment, right? But the people in the wing said, listen, it's one city, it's one night. Tomorrow's going to be completely different. And it was, in fact, different the following night, because in the following city, The booze began from the very first note and continued throughout his set. And this went on the third night of the tour and the fourth night and the fifth night and the sixth night. Till finally, the seventh night of the tour, July 17th, 1967, apparently word had traveled from city to city. And before the first note was even played, the booze began. And by this point, this young artist had had enough. I think any of us would have had enough. As legend has it, he put his guitar down, may or may not have waved a profane gesture at the audience, and he walked off stage and quit the tour, never again to tour as the opening act for this massively popular band. Now, again, I ask you, could you imagine how that would feel? You got your big break, your big opportunity, your big moment to be on a giant stage in an arena in front of thousands of people, and you get booed off stage seven nights in a row. If you were present that night, you might have thought you were witnessing one of the greatest failures in music history. I mean, it doesn't get much worse than that, right? But I would submit to you, you were witnessing something slightly different. If you were present on July 17th, 1967, when a young Jimi Hendrix took the stage to open for a band called The Monkees, I would submit to you, you were witnessing a very natural phenomenon. You're witnessing what happens when something new, something innovative, something heretofore unseen is introduced into a marketplace that largely craves conformity and predictability. Jimi Hendrix, in the words of Wes Cowell, had a spiky point of view. He was doing something different. He was playing music that hadn't really been heard before in that context. Monkees fans had no grid for Jimi Hendrix. Listen, the Monkees' music is fine, but it is pretty down-the-middle, predictable pop music, right? That's what it is. Jimi Hendrix represented a fundamentally new idea, a spiky point of view that had not been experienced by Monkees fans before. And so what was their natural response? Boo! It was to boo. It was to reject it. It was to push it away because they didn't have a grid to understand it. And friends, this is why in organizations, as leaders, as creative pros, it is so very important for all of us to understand it's not enough to have a spiky point of view. It's not enough to have an innovative perspective or a great idea. It's not enough to just be talented. We have to be able to translate that talent to the people that we intend to communicate with. And not only that, we have to recognize that that, as Wes calls it, spiky point of view, that uniqueness, that thing that we bring to the market that nobody else has, is going to be rejected initially because people may not understand it. But that, friends, that is our superpower. That is the thing that people will celebrate us for later. And we have to be careful not to allow it to become rounded off. It would have been really easy for Jimi Hendrix to monkeyize his Hendrix music in that moment just to get a few more rounds of applause from the adoring masses. But in so doing, he would have compromised the very thing that made him great. So my question for you is this: what is it about you that makes you unique? What is your spiky point of view? What is your unique creative superpower? And where do you feel pressure to round that off in order to achieve a little bit more applause from the adoring masses? I encourage you not to do it, friends, because we don't need another replica of the latest pop band. We need you to be you. And we all know how the story ends. Jimi Hendrix went on to transform generations of musicians because in the moment, he refused to make his music more palatable just to get a few rounds of applause. I encourage you to do the same. If you'd like to hear full interviews with Wes Kao and all of our guests, you can do so in the Daily Creative app at dailycreative.app. There you'll also get daily podcasts, courses, and the entire archives going back years and years. Again, that's at dailycreative.app. This is Daily Creative. My name is Todd Henry. Until next time, may you be brave, focused, and brilliant.